the hardest part of public holidays and festivals is that everybody feels they're supposed to be having such a good time, which, if you're not, only makes you feel worse as you up the ante and try for any port in a storm. Hi, I'm Brian Pearson, and you are in the cave.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure. And whatever comes our way. Yeah, darling, go make it happen. Take the world in a loving embrace. Fire all of your guns and pumps and explode into space. I like smoking lightning.
Welcome to the Mystic Cave, the summer edition. I'm reading from my novel, Passion Tide, published by Path Books in 2002. David has been assaulted by the elements and rebuffed by his congregation. If there's a light in his present darkness, it's not one he could have asked for or even imagined. This is Chapter 5, Part 1.
We can climb so high, I never wanna die. Born to be wild. Born to be wild.
Almost any given thing about David's Christmas on the coast would have been enough to drive him to despair. There was, of course, the weather, which continued foul, each new day bringing only a wearisome variation on a dark and stormy theme. Either there were high winds, or there was pelting rain, or there were high winds and pelting rain. David felt he had no choice but to curtail his daily excursions along the shoreline. Access to the rocky headlands had become too dangerous. Even the beaches were closed off to the public, massive tree trunk-sized driftwood pitching and tossing about in the surf like matchsticks. Still, with cabin fever setting in, David decided one day to mount a new assault on the blowhole. He suited up from head to toe in his rubber rain gear, parked the frog prints on the shoulder of the highway, and started out. His oversized rain pants squeaked as he trudged up the old road. He reached the turn in the trail where the bear droppings had been, but they were long since washed away by the small river that now flowed down the center of the track. He pushed on, his wellies splashing through the runoff. Sparse new growth lined the trail, opening the forest ceiling to the steady drizzle that spilled down from the low overhead clouds. David let the gravel road bed lead him onward. The trees receded for a piece as he traversed a broad meadow. Then he entered a dark stand of unlogged old-growth forest. He could see daylight up ahead as the tall trees gave way to the open sky beyond, indicating the meeting of land and sea. He was getting close. The road now forked before him, to the left and to the right, just as Cecil had said. Towering above him was an immense silver cedar, long dead, its bare, pointed branches reaching skyward like battle lances. Two lesser cedars nearby had also died, their roots rotting, and they had fallen into the upturned arms of this one stalwart guardian who was as stoic in his solitariness as an ancient helmeted knight, standing tall and proud, even in death, bearing up the hulks of his comrades who had fallen in battle. Cecil had said to stay left, and certainly the main path seemed to veer in that direction. But the trail was immediately swamped by a spreading rain-fed reservoir too broad and deep for David to cross. He doubled back and tried the path on the right. It seemed to lead promisingly in the direction of the ocean. But then the trail quickly grew in on itself, choked by the low, bent branches of a thicket, reduced to little more than a deer run, too small for a grown man to negotiate easily. With the wind howling in the trees above him and the rain now falling in sheets, David decided this was enough for today. He turned and headed for home. Thwarted in his attempts to reach the wilder portions of the coastline, David resigned himself to an alternative plan. Until the weather let up, he would content himself with a daily drive over to the lighthouse at Amphitrite Point at the southerly tip of the peninsula. There he could stand like a tourist on the public walkway and gaze out upon the roaring seas. So, day after day, in the late afternoon, that's what he did. Buffeted about by the stiff winds, he stood alone against the winter storms, as if being chastened. The mean gusts tore at his clothing, the driving rain beat down upon his shoulders, and the waves lashed out at the rocky headland, releasing hopeful billows of sea foam that danced and rose on swirling columns of air, only to be caught in the jet stream of the gale force winds and blasted apart. Returning to the rectory, he would dry himself off and make a tour of the house, turning on all the lights. He prepared paltry meals for himself in his Spartan kitchen, reheating rice from the day before, adding a stir-fry concoction of beef strips and vegetables, but without spices or sauce that would have raised it from the level of prison food. Then, aside from the weather, there was the sad dribble of Christmas cards and packages arriving just under the wire, no one in the East appreciating the long circuitous route taken by mail sent to this part of the world. It was hard to get into any mood even remotely approaching the holiday spirit. He felt so far removed, an entire continent away from the people who knew and loved him. A card from Beverly announcing the coming arrival of a package of Christmas presents from the family dealt him a particularly low blow. The generic seasonal card she had chosen wished him a joy-filled holiday Christmas, an odd and somewhat perverse sentiment, he thought, given the circumstances. But it got worse. In the enclosed note, Beverly confessed that it had been difficult doing the Christmas shopping this year, that Christmas itself already felt pretty much like a bust. She had even been tempted not to buy him a present, she said, though not out of spite. It was more because she could not imagine his life anymore. She had no idea what he was doing, where he was living, who the people were who populated his days. "What do you give someone you love but don't know any longer?" she asked. He had sent her a pair of locally handcrafted silver earrings, each one etched with an eagle's head. But he wondered now if that had been a mistake. Why would she want to wear something from this journey of his, a journey she did not share, a journey most likely that she deeply resented? These were symbols of his life, not hers. He imagined a Christmas morning her taking the earrings up to her room, away from Paul and Catherine, and silently dropping them into the bathroom wastebasket. The Christmas Eve services might otherwise have lit a little glow in David's heart. Both churches decked out with cedar boughs and the dark green holly that grows so abundantly in that fecund climate. But with his recent loss of anything resembling conventional faith, his sermon preparation kept hitting the bottom of the well and returning empty. A baby born in a small Judean town 2,000 years ago, just what did this have to do with us, he wondered. Ordinarily, he would have preached something about God being with us, Emmanuel, and all that. But God's presence had not been making itself known to him too clearly lately, so it would have been a stretch for him to go there. And then there was the train wreck of the services themselves. Having offered the carol service the previous Sunday evening, even though there had been no takers, David felt compelled to stick with his plan of celebrating Holy Communion on Christmas Eve. But the word hadn't got out, or perhaps had not been taken seriously to begin with, for both churches were filled mainly with strangers, fully expecting an hour or so of their favorite sing-along Christmas carols. David's words of welcome at the beginning of each service, inviting all baptized Christians to come forward when the time came to receive communion, a generous offer, David felt, considering the religious diversity of these communities, only served to set people off. A buzz ran through the congregations. What? This wasn't a carol service? What's communion? What's he talking about? The people belted out their beloved carols with vigor, but the traditional readings and prayers were met with cold stares and stony silence, especially the long prayer of consecration. People were waiting for the next carol, but waiting too long, judging by the looks on their faces. Some left before communion. Others chose to wait, stewing, and greet the new minister at the door to express, without much delicacy, their disappointment in this year's service. Some asked him how long he was staying, the corollary clear enough, but left unsaid. Back at the rectory, well past midnight, David consoled himself with a glass of scotch. Bishop Hovey's strange gift had accompanied David right across the country, tucked into the bottom of his suitcase. When he unpacked it, the bottle had been stashed at the back of the cupboard over the fridge, a cupboard that was otherwise bare. Out of sight, the bottle of 16-year-old Lafroig had remained also out of mind. But in the aftermath of last Sunday evening's fiasco, and now, after the Christmas Eve disaster, David remembered the bottle of whiskey and reached for its cold comfort. He stripped away the seal and pulled the cork. Instantly, the room filled with the astringent scent of Scottish peat and seaweed. He wasn't sure if maybe the whiskey had gone bad. He poured a couple of inches into a tall glass. Raising it to his nose, he couldn't bring himself to take a sip. He plopped two ice cubes into the glass, added a third and a fourth, and then passed the glass under the tap to add some water. Even then, the taste was awful. The whiskey burned the back of his throat going down. The aftertaste was even worse, but the kick was almost instantaneous. Sitting alone at the kitchen table, calling to mind entire pews of dark, disappointed faces, he took another sip, and another, until the glass was empty. His head spinning, a buzzing in his fingers and toes, he then tottered off to bed. David awoke to the pounding of rain against the window. It was dark, but he sensed that it was already day. His eyes were sore, his throat parched. He was glad, at least, that he had agreed not to do a Christmas Day service. He was about to roll over and go back to sleep when the telephone rang in the kitchen. He fumbled for his bathrobe and stumbled down the hall, picking up the phone on its third ring. "Merry Christmas, Dad," came the gleeful greeting. David smiled. "Merry Christmas, Catherine," he said, his voice low and unfamiliar, like a growl. "It's Christmas, Dad," she said, as if he might not have got it. I know, he said. "I just woke up. What time is it there?" "It's almost 9 o'clock," she said. "Mum wouldn't let us call before now." "Right," he said. He quickly calculated the time difference and realized it was only 6 in the morning. He rubbed his face with his free hand, trying to raise himself to their time zone. "Thanks for the sweater," she gushed. "It's really cool. No one here has one like it. Did the Indians make it?" "I'm so glad you like it," he said, deeply massaging his eye sockets. "I don't know if it was made by local people or what, but I'm glad you like it." He stifled a yawn. "Did you get our presents?" she asked him. "Not yet. I mean, I got them, but I haven't opened them yet. Do you want to hang on and I'll go get them? I could open them right now while you're on the phone." "Hi, Dad." Paul's voice broke in from an extension. He sounded more man than boy. "Hi, Paul. Merry Christmas." "Merry Christmas, Dad. Thanks for the books. They're great. They're all about your part of the West Coast, aren't they? They look really interesting." Dad's going to open his presents while we're on the phone, Catherine interjected. Okay, Dad, she went on. We'll wait while you go get them. All right, he said, just hang on. He went to the living room where he had placed his small pile of presents on the floor before the cold, empty fireplace. He picked out the ones bearing his family's names and brought them back to the kitchen. Standing by the counter in his bare feet, he pulled out a bright yellow package from Catherine. She had used several layers of boxes and wrapping, the size of the gift shrinking as he removed each new layer. Such tricks were her stock and trade. When finally he got to it, he unwrapped a CD titled Cool 3, a collection of 1990s chart-topping pop. He picked up the phone. Wow, Catherine, this is really neat. I'm sure I won't know a single song on here, but I guess that's the point, isn't it? Catherine giggled. Now you can be the coolest old guy on the left coast, she said. That's what people here call it when I tell them where you are. They say it's such a cool place to be, so I thought you should at least have some cool music to go with it. I love it, he said. Thank you, Catherine. Now I'm going to go over and open Paul's gift. He put the receiver down and began to unwrap a small present. The paper was festooned with green frogs in Santa Claus hats and Christmas ties like tipsy workers at an office party. It raised a thin smile to David's dry lips. Inside were two gifts, wrapped separately in tissue paper. One was a tie, a fun design featuring frogs, some sitting, some swimming, some leaping. The other was a keychain, a squatting frog with a crown on its head, holding the small chain links in his mouth. Wow, this is great, Paul, David said into the phone. In honor of the frog prince, of course, Paul explained. I got it, David chuckled. Thank you so much, Paul. Is your mom there? Yeah, she's right here, Paul said. David could hear Beverly covering the mouthpiece, telling Catherine to get off the phone. Merry Christmas, David, she said when she came on. Merry Christmas, Bev, he said. I sure wish I was there with you all. I'm really missing you. It just came out. He hadn't intended to open things up. Not right away and not like that, but there it was. We miss you too, she said. She asked him how he was. He began to choke up as he answered her that things were going okay. He struggled to regain his composure. She asked how the Christmas services had gone, safer territory. Pretty disastrous, actually, he said, but he didn't want to go into it. Thanks for the earrings, she said. They're beautiful. You think so? He asked. Yes, she said. I'm glad you like them. I'll go get your present now. He reached for the one remaining gift, wrapped in a tasteful paper with a Dickensian Christmas montage, quite formal for Beverly. Tearing away the wrapping, David found himself holding a book in hardcover. Lost and Found, it was titled, with the subtitle, Learning to Wait Upon the Lord. He turned it over in his hand. He did not recognize the author, but the subject was right on the money. This looks excellent, he said. Thank you, Bev. They were both silent for a moment. He could hear the faint conversations of other Christmas callers on other telephone lines, distant and jumbled, ghostly echoes spiraling down long cross-country corridors, the voices of other exiles. The thing I want to know, David, she broke in, the thing I need to know is, are you finding what you're looking for? I don't know yet, he said. I wish I did. Sometimes I wonder what I'm doing here. Other times, it feels like there is something happening, though I can't explain what it is, so I don't know. Are you coming back? She asked him, straight out. Not when are you coming back, which might have been a guarded euphemism, but going instead right to the heart of the issue. It was so like her, and he remembered why it was he loved her. David had no reason to think he wasn't coming back. No cause for seeing this as the beginning of a permanent separation. It certainly did not feel like he was building a new life for himself here. As far as he was concerned, his intentions of returning at the end of the 6 months remained unchanged. Yet he found himself stalling. When finally he answered her that yes, of course he was coming back, too much time had elapsed. It no longer sounded convincing, even to him. After he hung up the phone, David climbed the stairs to the attic and slumped onto his prayer mat. Gazing out across the Black Harbor, he let his mind wander off to the exposed face of Mount Ozard, which he knew was out there somewhere, hidden behind the curtain of driving rain. Later in the day, David made his pilgrimage to the lighthouse, paying homage to the unrelenting winds and angry seas. He stood his ground for as long as he could, holding down the hood of his rain shell before the full blast of the gale. His body registered each blow as the hard ground rumbled beneath his feet. When he returned home, battered and blown and soaked at every seam of his rain gear that didn't hold, he dried himself off and, with the towel draped about his shoulders, began rummaging through the kitchen cupboards, searching for something to prepare for his Christmas dinner, something to salvage the day. But a knock came at the door. It was Cecil, standing on the porch, an old oil slicker protecting his thin body from the rain, but leaving his wispy hair dripping wet. "Hello, Cecil," he said, without disguising his weariness. "Merry Christmas to you." "I'm cooking up some duck," the old man said without expression. "You want to come over and have some duck?" David had neither the presence of mind nor the reserve of energy to think up an excuse. "Sure," he said. "I'll just finish off a few things here and then I'll be over." David didn't want to go to Cecil's. It felt like hard work to him, and he found himself resenting his willing compliance on this, his day off, and Christmas Day to boot. He chided himself for not having made plans as he began looking about for something to take as a gift. He picked up a bottle of white wine, a Christmas present from Paula and Harve. "This'll do," he thought, and he slipped it back into its gift bag. Cecil was already pulling the bird apart when David knocked on the door and let himself in. There were so many competing odors that hit him as he stepped into the cottage, many of them pungent, few of them pleasant, that it was hard to discern precisely the aroma of the roast duck. Two places were set at the table. David placed the bottle of wine on the counter. Cecil acknowledged the gift with his eyes, but said nothing. David asked Cecil where he kept his wine glasses. A foolish question. "Or glasses of any kind," he quickly added. Cecil motioned with his jaw to the cupboard over the sink. David drew down two mismatched tumblers. He opened the wine with the corkscrew he had brought, half-filled both glasses, and took his place at the table. Cecil served up the duck, along with lumpy mashed potatoes and dripping slices of mushy tomatoes. David helped himself to a dinner roll and, while Cecil's back was turned, cut off a few small spots of blue mold that were forming on its underside. His appetite was waning. David should have been grateful for Cecil's hospitality. He knew this was a lot of work for the old man. But he was not grateful. He did not want to be here. He just wanted to be home, if only he could figure out where that was right now. "You better say something," Cecil said as he sat down. David said a quick grace, tucked a paper napkin into his belt, took a deep breath, and began slicing into the hunk of dead duck piled on his plate. As he took his first forkful and bit down, something cracked in his mouth, and a sudden pain shot up through his cheek. "Shot this duck myself," Cecil was saying. "Might still be some shot in her," he said, glancing over at David's grimacing face. "You got some, did you?" David reached into his mouth, sifted through the wad of unmasticated duck, and extracted a tiny lead ball, along with a splinter of tooth. He placed both at the side of his plate. His eyes closed against tears of rising rage. He held on to the edge of the table with both hands, his tongue exploring the sharp cutting edge of his broken tooth. It was all he could do not to get up and leave, but he had been too well trained for that. So he forced himself to remain, to do the honorable thing, the polite thing, to carry on. "So you see," Cecil began, "the thing about the blowhole..." I know, David snapped back, surprising himself. "It's at the top of my list of New Year's resolutions." Cecil eyed his guest across the table. They finished the meal in silence. When they had risen from the table and cleared their plates, the old man motioned for David to follow him. David was unable to find the words to properly excuse himself, so he allowed Cecil to lead him to the rear of the cottage, to a stuffy, wood-paneled living room with a large picture window overlooking the harbor. There on a TV table in the middle of the room was a bottle of brandy, two brandy snifters, and two fat cigars. David smiled in spite of himself. Bless him, he thought. Cecil had planned this out. What sort of pathetic ingrate was he to have resented the old man's hospitality? What a miserable wretch! Cecil motioned toward the chair by the window, which opened out onto the black night. David caught his reflection in the glass. It was not reassuring. He was overdressed for the occasion, as usual, in gray flannel dress pants and the new pullover sweater his mother had sent him for Christmas, as if he had just walked out of a Sears catalog. Here, washed up like driftwood in Cecil's smelly, ramshackle cabin, it only made David feel foolish. But that was not the main problem. Something else was wrong with this picture. David's hair was tousled, and even in the dark reflection he could see that his eyes were swollen and red. He was not a picture of health and happiness. His tongue reached round to explore again at the sharp edge of his tooth. Everything felt broken. All of this, or any of it, the swirling winter weather, the disastrous Christmas services, the lonely distance he had placed between himself and his family, the gruff hospitality of a stranger, might have sent David into a spiraling blue funk. But in truth, he was being saved from despair by a single ray of light, a celestial image that shone before him now through the gloom like a guiding presence. It was the image of a cellist, caught in the soft edges of a spotlight, her dark hair tied back by a velvet ribbon, elegantly poised to play, serenely attentive to the task before her, unearthly in her beauty.
We were born, born to be wild. We can climb so high.
I've been reading from my novel, Passion Tide. Next time, as the dark days of winter drive David indoors, they also drive him inwards, where the unacknowledged phantoms of his shadow life rise up to haunt him and reveal the work he's refused to do by the light of day. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave.